This podcast is brought to you with limited interruption by Rudy Luther Toyota. Whether looking for an exciting brand new Toyota, a certified pre-owned vehicle, or getting quality routine maintenance and service for your vehicle, Rudy Luther Toyota is the place to go. Rudy Luther Toyota, the southeast corner of 394 and 169 in Golden Valley. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's the Matt McNeil Show for your Tuesday. Good to be with you, Matt. Patrick here. Yeah, I had one of those moments where I was like, what day is it here? Because, of course, obviously, I took the day off yesterday. I want to thank Brett and yourself, Patrick, for helping me get a day out because I needed it. And it was also my kids are in spring break. And so we wanted to have at least one day where my wife took the day off, I took the day off, and we went out and did something.
It seemed like a great day. It was, 70 degrees yesterday? Of course, just long enough that you're back in and it's in the 40s today.
Yeah, don't tell me the weather's not broken. Holy cow, what in the world is going on? Yeah. Yeah, everything's just perfectly fine. Watching, Sven Sundgaard's Twitter feed to make sure he's not pulling out his hair because this is some weird weather, that's for sure. So I got out on Saturday. I went down to beautiful Red Wing, Minnesota. Lovely town. They got some hills down there. And was it Barn Hill or Barn Top or Barn Knoll or that was a little bit of a hike. Have you ever gone down there, Patrick, and done the hills down there?
I've driven through it. I haven't done any hiking.
Well, you see, and there you and I are similar. Barn Bluff. You and I are similar. There's one that's supposed to be open. And we looked at the website for the city of Red Wing and it says it's open. And we get down there and it's closed. And I said, well, I don't want to hike to the top of one of these things. I mean, because if you've not been down to Red Wing, because it's right there on the river, they have these just huge hills. They're great. If you get to the top of them, you get some spectacular views. But we were going to go to Frontenac State Park anyway and do some hiking over there. So I didn't necessarily want to do that. Well, for some reason, the city of Red Wing did not have the lookout properly labeled. It said it was open, it was closed. We didn't want to walk there. So I go to Barn Bluff and I start climbing up Barn Bluff, and Barn Bluff is just a delight. It was pouring rain on Saturday, so I was soaked. But we got you basically climb what is about the equivalent of 20 flights of stairs, you know, to get to the 20th floor of a building. And that's when you get to the stairs, the Kiwanis Club, Red Wing Kiwanis Club stairs that go to the rest of the way up. Oh, great view. Spectacular view from up there. Even on a bit of a cloudy, rainy day, it was quite spectacular. I ran across crocus flowers, of all things. That was not something I was expecting to see. I got to the top of that hill, and the last thing I expected to see in late March was flowers, and there were a ton up there on the side facing towards Red Wing. Really pretty, too. Nice. I put some pictures up there. So did that, and then I went down to Frontenac State Park. And, of course, there is the town of Frontenac, or is it Old Frontenac? I think it might be Old Frontenac, which is just it's ancient old river town, which is there are very few places in Minnesota from the European settler perspective that look old in that regards. Look East Coast old. I mean, you go on the East Coast and you'll come across neighborhoods where the houses were built in the 1770s, 1780s, and it's got a lot. They're quite old. There are not many places, but you could tell this town of Frontenac, they had some age to it. You could tell that at some point this was an old, old neighborhood. And apparently they used to have the river boats come up there and was a popular place for vacationers coming up the Mississippi River. Lost in Time. Quite cute. Enjoyed that. And then stop by that art high school. Is it Anderson in Red Wing? That's there. Quite nice. And, you know, that was lovely. On Sunday. Sunday I went to the Walker, which is always a nice thing. It's just an amazing thing. And then on yesterday, we went down to Sakata, SakataH State Park, which is down by Waterville. So you go down to Faribault, jump on, was that Minnesota 60, and you head towards Mankato. And about halfway between Mankato and Faribault is this park. Not a big park, but – and I can tell that the best time to go to that park is either in summer or in fall. And I bet you in fall it is as spectacular as it gets. But it was quite nice. It was pretty nice still. Even though it was no leaves on the trees, it was quite nice out there. I got some pictures. I'll get those up here eventually. I got to get those edited down. But, yeah. It was a lovely trip. I'm very grateful to get out and very grateful. And once again, I want to make a plea here because as we have so many people who are currently, oh, I'm going to go down to Mazatlan. I'm going to go down to Cancun. I'm going to go down to Florida. I'm going to go down to Arizona. And you can, but it's pretty dangerous still. I'll get to the Minnesota coronavirus update here in a little bit, but it's pretty dangerous still. If I may make the suggestion, there are a lot of pretty dang spectacular areas of this state which are not crowded. I mean, we front now, granted, on the Sunday, on Saturday, it was raining. So that kind of kept the crowds down. But there still were a few people out there, but not a lot. Nothing that I felt like it was too much crowd. The Walker, they've got time entry into that. They're one of the many museums you get timed entry, but you get plenty of time. The galleries are big. You get plenty to look at. Great. And the Sakata Park, I was going to stay, if I saw three people total the entire time, they got that great bike trail that cuts through that park that runs. It's paved. It runs from Faribault all the way over to Mankato. That is a spectacular bike trail. And, yeah, there were one or two people on that, but I didn't really see anyone else hiking. So, you know, you get this great state parks. Get out there and enjoy them. You'll find some really pretty places. Might even find some flowers, like I did up on the top of Barn Bluff. And you can go on out there and you know, appreciate Minnesota from east to west, north to south. And I'm not – there is a – if you go down, you drive down towards Red Wing, there is a delight of a house. As you get down, I think it might just be right before you get to Red Wing, which is just this, it looks like a haunted house. It's just all, you know, dirty and falling apart. And of course, there's a Trump flag on. Yeah. Keep America great again. One of those things. And I say, you're going to get that. But the reality is I was in Waterville. I stopped by the local store there. I got a chat with the woman. She was the one to come back in fall. That park is spectacular. We got a lot of fun things in this town. You should, you know, come back this summer. Got some good cookies. Bought a few things in the store. That's how you do it. And, yeah, I don't have any doubt that most of the people that you talk to in these rural communities might vote Trump. But the reality is that, you know, there are a lot of great places in the state. And, you know, as long as, you know, most people generally, especially in this day and age, after 4 years of this, we don't want to necessarily start with your political affiliation when you walk in the door. So, you know, I would highly encourage you, even, you know, regardless of who you are, if you're outstate Minnesota or Republican, come into the cities. There's tons of things to do in the cities. And a lot of things to do outside. I mean, there are trails and parks everywhere in this town. And there are tons of museums. You just have to get a timeline to get in. You have to get reservations to get into most of them still. But still lots of things to do. If you're in the city right now, head on out to outstate Minnesota. Go see that stuff. The snow is gone for the most part, at least south of, I'd say, Mille Lacs. They said it was iced out on Lake Minnetonka now. Go out and enjoy it. Because this is, you know, and trust me, I've got some vacations planned later this year. I'm going to attempt to try to go down and visit my mother down in South Carolina. I'm looking forward to that, but I trust me on a few things. One, I'm not going to go unless it's safe. Even if we're all vaccinated, I'm probably not going to go unless it's safe. They're smart and stupid, and smart is basically waiting for the pandemic to pretty much be over before we declare it over, because I've had enough of people who think that through bravado and volume, they can basically shout down a virus, and I'm tired of it, so... 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205. Now, I am going to, obviously I missed the first day of the Derek Chauvin trial. The what I'm going to do here over the next few days is I will, whenever I do an update here, there's going to be one of two Twitter feeds I'm going to go off of. One is Unicorn Riot, and I've told you about these. These are the independent journalists, and they're pretty darn spectacular. They have their coverage on a lot of things is quite good. The other one is Dina Winter from Minnesota Reformer. She as well. I'll be talking about her Twitter feed. She's covering this fairly clearly as well. Today, though, I'm going to go with the Unicorn Riot guys, and she and talk about we're going to go through what happened here today. I will say this. This was not a good day for the defense. This was not a good day for the defense in any capacity. And if I was, frankly, and I'm not a defense lawyer. I am not. We've got Jack Rice who comes on the air with us and talks legal matters with us. And I would say this. After what I saw today, if I was Chauvin's lawyers, I would be calling the prosecutor saying, what's the deal on the table? Because I can't believe after today, I would be shocked if second degree murder isn't the ruling. I would be shocked. We started off today. I'll go a little bit through it here. Donald Williams. Now, this is the MMA fighter. He was an eyewitness to the murder. He was there on the scene. He's talking about chokeholds. Now, this yesterday, he kind of got into chokeholds a little bit. Chokeholds, blood chokes, other chokes. Well, Nelson is questioning Williams about his training and how chokes are defined. Williams referred to notes he took upon to look upon the name of FBI agents that questioned him for witnessing the death of George Floyd. Nelson, who had asked Williams to put his notes away earlier, now asked him this time to get permission from court to look at his notes. Permission was granted. So basically they were saying, you can't have your notes. But then all of a sudden he couldn't remember the name. So they said, get him to have his notes back. According to Chauvin, attorney for Chauvin continues to try to get witness Williams to say he was angry. But Williams responds he was professional. Nelson seems to be attempting to show that Williams was a nuisance who made the officer's jobs harder on May 25th. Now, this was, in my mind, there were two things about this which were a massive mistake for the defense. Let me give you a little inside radio stuff. Whenever you're writing a commercial ad, don't ask a question at the beginning of a commercial ad where the person who's listening to it could say no, and then they won't listen to the rest of the commercial ad. So, well, do you have horrible itch in the nether regions? No. Okay, so the rest of the ad is a pointless thing. You're not going to listen to it, right? If you're a defense attorney, you got to make sure you don't basically allow the witness to take your entire argument and throw it out the window like Williams did. Now, granted, Williams was giving his personal opinion on what was going on, and the defense at no point was striking his comments, which was really kind of odd. But this whole thing now, Mr. Williams is an African-American. He's a black man. And it clearly seemed to me that this defense at this point was going to try to argue that the 9.5-minute video, that didn't matter. The eyewitness testimony didn't matter. It's all Minneapolis was good police work, and Minneapolis is just a city full of angry black men. And a major linchpin was Williams, where he kept trying, because Williams was clearly pleading with these officers to get off of George Floyd. And the fact that George Floyd is dead means that Williams was right. Please stop. He called him some names. He used some salty language. He indeed did. But at the same time, here's where the defense walked into the rake in the yard. Is they basically kept saying, you're an angry black man. You were angry. Well, just they were trying to get him to say angry. He is a black man, but they were trying to get him to say angry. And he said, I was controlled. I was professional because I stayed on the curb. And the minute he said that, it's like, oh, yeah, your entire, it's not like he jumped on Chauvin himself and tried to drag him off of George Floyd. No, he followed the orders of the law enforcement personnel, the four officers on the scene. And so at that moment, if there, and I think that that was what they were going to go with, is that anyone who witnessed this was just angry people who hate cops. And so you got to ignore the testimony, and the city of Minneapolis is just a bunch of angry, angry anti-cop people. And that's what happened. And the reality is what comes out happening is Mr. Williams looks professional. He looks like he was a concerned citizen. And frankly, he looked like he was a more competent police officer at that moment than Derek Chauvin was. The attorney for the state questioning Williams now asking him what happens if an opponent is rendered unconscious during one of his MMA fights. Williams says the fight stops right away and medical steps in. Assistant Minnesota Attorney General Frank asked Williams if he saw George Floyd resisting during his arrest. No. And if Floyd lost consciousness, correct. It felt like you had to speak up for Floyd, Williams explained on why he continued yelling at the officers when Derek Chauvin's knee was on Floyd's neck. Williams said the officers weren't listening to Floyd. So Judge Cahill then told him he could answer until the judge said he could, and then the Williams was excused from the stand. He did make the point as well, is that if you are in distress, you can always tap out in a match. And so that was the other thing, too, is that they were going to kind of go after him as an MMA fighter because, well, how would you know what's bad chokehold, what's a good chokehold? And he basically went through, explained it, and also explained, yeah, that in an MMA fight, in a freaking MMA fight, there are more rules about keeping people safe than what Derek Chauvin showed George Floyd. Then he was excused. I'll take a break. Come on back. We'll run the rest of the day so far of what's been going on in the trial. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. I am very angry still about what's been going on here because, yeah, this is just reopening the wounds. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It is the Matt McNeil Show, 952-946-6205. Running through Unicorn Riot's Twitter feed, which was covering the trial today. Once again, the next four witnesses were not shown on the stream because of their age, according to Judge Cahill. Another attorney for the state, Jerry Blackwell, questioning the first young witness who had just turned 18. She was walking to Cup Foods on May 25th with her younger cousin. She said she walked to Cup Foods hundreds, maybe thousands of times. She felt safe doing so. Blackwell submits Exhibit 13 into evidence, a picture showing the witness and her younger cousin on the right and the police SUV pardon me, on the left. Exhibit 16 is played. Witness breathes heavily. The video shows the two walking to Cup Foods in the background. In the foreground, Floyd is on the ground and police officers are on top of him. Witnesses walked her cousin into the store and walked back to the police vehicle by herself and pulled out her phone. I heard George Floyd saying, "I can't breathe." She heard Floyd calling out for his mom. She says he was suffering. Witnesses are sniffling, taking deep breaths when shown the picture of Derek Chauvin kneeling on George Floyd's neck. She says a minute later, she stood by the police vehicle. Other bystanders joined her. Exhibit 184 is the picture of the bystanders. At least 10 people. We all knew it wasn't right when describing what her and the other bystanders saw. That part of her answer was stricken. Witnesses say she didn't see violence from the bystanders, but saw violence from the cops, from Chauvin, from Officer Tao. When Chauvin was kneeling on Floyd's neck, and two other officers were also holding him down. Witnesses say Floyd said he was in pain and that his neck and back hurt and he couldn't breathe. One of the other bystanders said she was a firefighter and yelled at the officers to check Floyd's pulse. The witness says the officers never checked his pulse. Witnesses say Chauvin didn't let up on Floyd's neck at all, even as the bystander firefighter asked him to check his pulse. Then there was a recess. Question continues of the young female witness. Blackwell is asking if she saw Floyd go unconscious while Chauvin was kneeling on his neck. She said yes and said she didn't see him conscious again after that. Chauvin's attorney Nelson is questioning now. He is asking her to confirm what she did when she got to Cup Foods. Nelson is confirming that the witness and the other bystanders were speaking to the officers. The witness filmed the main video that went viral of Chauvin and Floyd. Nelson is also asking about other noises from traffic and or bystanders across the street. The witnesses say when she was filming, she only saw Chauvin and Tao, but didn't notice the other two officers or hear them. Nelson says the witness to agree If the noise got louder and the bystander group got larger as time went on, then 25th, she agrees. The witnesses confirmed that Officer Tao told her that you can breathe if you can talk. Well, really, officer? Because I don't think George Floyd was breathing. Seems like you guys were best being thugs. Wow. The witness shares that she bottles things up, has social anxiety, but when she saw the scene, she was loud sometimes. The witnesses get emotional, and Blackwell asks how May 25th has affected her. She said she thinks of her dad and other family members who are also black. She says she stays up at night saying sorry to George Floyd that she didn't do more to help him. Witness is excused. Next young witness is approaching the stand. The second witness, a third grader, is 9 years old. The 9 year old witnessed this. She's the younger cousin of the previous witness. Blackwell asks what she saw when she came to the Cup Foods. She says she saw Chauvin on top of George Floyd. She says she saw the ambulance came. The medics asked Chauvin to get off George Floyd. She says Chauvin didn't get off. The medics had to pull the officer off of George Floyd's dead body. The paramedics had to literally wrestle the officer off of the man. Nelson passed for questioning. The 9-year-old witness was excused. The witness, next witness, was an 18-year-old, a senior in high school. She lived in Minneapolis her whole life. She said she drove to Cup Foods on May 25th, and her friend was in the passenger seat. She was 17 at the time. When she pulled up, she noticed the police car right before I walked in the door. I saw there were four police officers and George was outside. She said she didn't know George Floyd's name at the time, but learned of it later. I knew initially something was wrong. She described what other bystanders seemed in distress, and George Floyd also seemed in distress. She saw Derek Chauvin kneeling on George Floyd's neck and saw two other officers holding his lower half down. She says at first Floyd was vocal but started talking less, and it seemed like it was harder for him to speak, spitting when he spoke. The witness takes a few moments to breathe and blow her nose. She takes a deep breath and says it is difficult to talk about because she felt like there was nothing she could do. She felt like there was failing to help him. She couldn't do physically what she wanted to do. She didn't see the three officers move from Floyd's body. She said they continued putting pressure on him until paramedics came. She knows that Chauvin added more weight pressure into Floyd. He lifted his back leg up and put his front knee down more on Floyd's neck. I'll get back to that in a second. The witness said the police officers didn't move, and Chauvin kept his knee on Floyd's neck even when paramedics were checking Floyd's pulse. Wow. She shares how she and the other bystanders were on the curb together and didn't get close to Floyd's body. She shared that she knows Darnell, the other 18-year-old witness who testified earlier, went to school together. Exhibit 246 will be published. Shown on the stream, it may contain violence. There's currently a sidebar. The video 246 was played showing Chauvin and two other officers on top of George Floyd. The witness's phone video was shown to the right of the stream. You can hear George Floyd crying out as Derek Chauvin is kneeling on his neck, calling for his mom, saying his neck and stomach, everything hurts. The witness asked Chauvin, why are you kneeling on him more during the May 25th phone video she took, which was being shown in the stream. The video from the witness's phone shows Floyd's eyes closed and he was not moving and is quiet. Bystanders, including the witness, call out to the officer that he's not been moving for over a minute and ask them to check his pulse. At that point, I kind of knew he was dead or not breathing. The witness expresses why she was upset and yelling at the video at about 8:27 p.m. She says that the paramedics checked his eyes and pulse, didn't say anything, and put him on the gurney. She says now she wanted to walk away because it was so hard to watch, but she didn't leave because she was witnessing what was wrong. She explains how she felt numb after that, how it was a lot to take in, and she hasn't returned to Cup Food since that day. By the way, to all these witnesses, Godspeed to you because you witnessed something you should never have to witness. On this planet, you witnessed something you should not have to witness. Nelson then started questioning the girl. Nelson asked if she remembers telling law enforcement, prosecution, that the officers on the scene checked Floyd's pulse. She said she remembers saying they might have. Nelson approaches witness stand, shows the transcript to her. Nelson has her read the transcript in her head. In the transcript, it stated she told officers she saw on-scene officers May 25th check Floyd's pulse multiple times. Nelson, who asked if there was other bystanders who were angry, she said she was. So once again, back to the everyone here is angry. It's them, not us, who killed the guy. Hey. Redirect back to the state. The attorney says, if reading the transcript jogged her memory, she said yes, and that she wasn't actually sure if it did check Floyd's pulse multiple times, but that there was movement from two other officers on his lower half. She says she did not see Chauvin's attempt to check all Floyd at all to check Floyd's pulse, and if any of the officers did, it was either one of the two on the lower half. She says she also said during and after the possible checks, the three officers remained on top of Floyd's body. Witness was excused. There was a short break. Fourth youth witness was on the stand. Video of the witness not shown because they were minors on May 25th. The witness is 17 years old, a senior in high school. She was a friend of the previous witness who arrived at Cup Foods via the car. As her and her friend were driving up to Cup Foods, they passed the squad car and heard George Floyd calling for his mom. Her friend borrowed her phone to record the scene, and the witness stayed in the car. She said she heard bystanders getting loud. She heard Floyd saying he couldn't breathe. As bystanders got loud, she got out of the car. It was kind of like a gut feeling. It sounded serious. When she got close to the group of bystanders, she saw that says that Floyd was unconscious because he wasn't speaking anymore. She saw Chauvin digging his knee into Floyd's neck because of the foot movements. The witness, she said she was asked why Chauvin was still on top of Floyd. There was no response. She said the officer Tao was really hostile. The witness says that while Chauvin was kneeling on Floyd's neck, he grabbed his mace and started shaking it at bystanders. She said she was scared. When the ambulance arrived on the scene, she says a paramedic motioned to Chauvin to get up of Floyd, and it was the first time she saw Chauvin get off of him. She says Floyd looked purple and that her gut feeling was that he was dead. She didn't see anyone before paramedics checked Floyd's pulse. The defense passed on questioning the witnesses stepping down from the stands. And I'll take a break at that point. But once again, there's some trends here I'll get to, and I'm going to wrap all this up when we get to the end of today's testimony, at least where we're getting caught up to today's testimony. But there's one witness who initially thought that they had checked her pulse, but she did not remember. No one else remembers them checking his pulse. So, and the most damning example of this is about to come up on the witness stand. I'll get to the paramedics' testimony when we do return. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. And indeed, some of the best session one you'll have here in town. Fantastic over a Great Wall. 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205. Once again, I'm going through the Twitter feed of Unicorn Riot today. You'll see me probably go to with either Dina Winner over from the Minnesota Reformer or else Unicorn Riot. I think that their coverage has been pretty good. As a matter of fact, it's pretty substantial. As you can tell, I've been talking a lot here just to get through these witnesses. But I think it's important to kind of get as much context as you can. And these two seem to be the better ones, the ones I've been following today. They take another break. The cell phone video is being played in court, shows bystanders pleading with officers as George Floyd had become motionless lying on the ground. Officer Tao moves to block the camera's view of Floyd. Now, once again, I want to make sure we point out something. The defense seems to be trying to portray a lot of the witnesses as angry. But the reality is every time they play this, you have a group of people pleading with these officers, for God's sakes, protect and serve, for goodness sakes. Isn't that what's on your car? Protect and serve. And, you know, these people are begging the officers to do their job and not murder George Floyd. And, of course, Officer Tao, hey, he's got to make sure no one's filming this. Stop your filming. That's the most important thing for cops. Video shows an ambulance arriving, Floyd's motionless body being put away on the stretcher, taken away. Genevieve Hansen is the next on the stand. She's a bystander who is also a firefighter. State is questioning Hansen, asking her to explain her training. She went to Pathways Academy, a three-month program. The test she had to take at the end of the program involved written parts and hands-on portions. She passed and received a certification. She also has an EMT certification, meaning she can start any basic wound bandaging, CPR, assessing a patient. Hansen explained. So, you see, they can argue all they like about just people that were there in front of Cup Foods. Here you have a firefighter, an EMT. Hansen explains what CPR is used for and why it's used, and that is to recover the heartbeat. She says she had entered buildings that are on fire, and she has pulled victims out of buildings. However, the majority of her cases are medical calls, not fire calls. Hansen said she has done CPR on people who don't have pulses and have assessed the victims many times. And in an average 24-hour shift, she can respond to someone without a pulse anywhere from 1 to 5 times. On May 25th, Hansen was going for a walk and sat in a community garden for a while. Decided to go down a busy street and get home because she was getting dark. It was getting dark. She approached Cup Foods. She saw red and blue lights. She heard a woman yelling across the street from Cup Foods to the officers that they were killing someone. So she asked the woman what was happening. Hansen then crossed the street closer to the squad car. When asked why Hansen moved closer, she said, "I was concerned to see a handcuffed man who was not moving with officers with their whole body weight on his back and a crowd that was stressed out." Exhibit 11, a video being shown, shows Hansen crossing the street towards the squad car where she stops in the street. Officer Tower demands she gets on the sidewalk and she complies. Hansen says she recognized Chauvin's face when she got closer to the scene. She didn't know him, but she had seen him in a recent call. She says how it was concerning to see three officers on top of Floyd because that's a lot of weight. The first thing that concerned her was that his face was smushed into the ground and looked swollen. Hansen said she thought his face looked puffy and swollen, which would happen if a lot of weight was on the neck. She saw fluid coming from Floyd's body, and she thought it might be urine. She has seen urine leaving patients' bodies when they die. She recognized this was an issue right away because Chauvin seemed comfortable with the majority of his weight on Floyd's neck. She mentions how Chauvin had been has his hands in his pockets. She says he wasn't distributing the weight elsewhere. So he basically all of his weight was on the neck. Hansen said there was no medical assistance on the scene, and she felt like she could have been allowed to help. She already decided to leave his level of consciousness. If she was allowed to help, she would have had someone call for fire and ambulance, etc. She would have asked to find an AED, look into Floyd's airway, check his spine, check for a pulse, do a chest compressions. If no pulse was found, Hansen begins to cry on the witness stand. Hansen continues to sniffle as she answers more questions. She says, once she noticed Floyd was unconscious, she pled with officers to check his pulse to get him medical care. After the ambulance left with Floyd, Hansen stayed on the scene standing. The state attorney asked her what she was going through her head. She said she didn't know. She was in disbelief. Hansen states that the human was denied that right of medical care, referring to George Floyd. She's also referred to Chauvin kneeling on Floyd's neck as killing. A fire truck arrived on scene after the ambulance had already left. Hansen spoke with them. She thought this was weird because that type of poor communication isn't normal. Defense attorney Nelson is questioning Hansen now. He asked her to confirm she was not wearing a uniform on May 25th. She confirms that she was saying off duty. Nelson asked her about the stress of being a firefighter, if she had the training on the physical reaction of stress. Nelson asks if Hansen knows about tunnel vision. She says she has heard of it and knows about it. Nelson lays out a hypothetical to Hansen. You're outside of a burning building. You're spraying the water hose on the fire. You may notice a citizen filming what you're doing. Would you interfere with your job? Hansen said no. Nelson asked if Hansen would be distracted if someone was yelling at her and telling her she was doing her job wrong. Hansen responded that she's confident in her job and confident in her training, and therefore no, it wouldn't distract her. Nelson then asked if it is reasonable to assume that when Hansen arrived on the scene that police had already called medics. She said yes, but it was taking an abnormally long time. Nelson asked Hansen if she knows what a load and go is. She says yes, and that's to move to the safe scene to begin medical work. Nelson brings up how the fire truck got there after the ambulance left. But Hansen mentioned how that was also abnormal. Nelson asked Hansen about Narcan and about responding to overdoses. She says, as the police were also called when responding to an overdose, because when people come out an overdose, they can be combative. She said, yes, but people are not always combative. So, you know, there clearly is an attempt here to label a lot of stuff that's going on here something else. Nelson asked Hanson if she grew upset or angry as time went on. May 25th, she said, no, I felt desperate. She had to confirm that she called an officer the B word. She said once Floyd was loaded in the ambulance, she got angry because Floyd was already killed. Nelson asked if other bystanders were yelling, which Hanson confirms. He then asked her to confirm that Chauvin looked comfortable when kneeling on Floyd's neck. Nelson looked over the transcript of the conversation between Hanson and law enforcement agents on the 25th. He asked Hanson to confirm or recall what she said during the conversation. So now that's about 18 seconds ago. So they're still testifying right now. I'll keep checking on that. Today is a hard day, and I'm not going to try to imply in any way, shape, or form that it's harder on me than most other people. I'm just a witness here to history. I'm not going to try to magnify anything I'm feeling right now. George Floyd's family, obviously, is the first place I would go. These witnesses who bravely are standing up to a system which, for God's sakes, reminder, Bob Kroll wrote a letter saying how these officers were wrongly treated after this. Holy crap. The paramedics, I keep thinking about, so multiple people said the paramedics had to literally wrestle Chauvin off the body. And you have to ask yourself, were the paramedics concerned at that point that Derek Chauvin would throw them on the ground and jump on them and place his knee in the back of their neck? What these – I started off by talking about how if you're the defense, this has been a nightmare day for you because – we have multiple witnesses stating the same thing. George Floyd wasn't fighting. George Floyd was lying on the ground underneath three police officers. One of them had his knee in the back of his neck. He was clearly in distress, and the officers did not care. Multiple witnesses today insisted that when people started pleading with Derek Chauvin to get off of George Floyd, that Chauvin drove his knee harder into the back of George Floyd and looked smugly at them. He did not care. He did not care. I'm of the mindset when I watch that video now, I see an officer who said, yeah, I'm killing him. What are you going to do about it? Which goes back to what I have been saying on this show about how the Republicans in this state have given police such leeway that they can be drunk in a bar off duty, say, I'm going to go get my gun and shoot you. Go drive home, get a gun, come back to the bar off duty, drunk as a skunk, shoot a guy. And all they have to do is say, I was scared, and they'll get away with it. Because the Republicans have written the laws that way. And this seems like to me that Derek Chauvin was indeed, this was kind of his thing. It's disturbing to me. It's just disturbing to me that this another human being did this to another human being. And this is a police officer doing this to a suspect. And for 9.5 minutes, kneeling on the back of his neck, doing so, not taking his pulse. Multiple people. One person said she thought they did. She changed her testimony on the stand. Everyone else said they never saw him once take a pulse on George Floyd. He didn't care. He didn't care. And even when the paramedics got there, the paramedics had to wrestle him off of the body. This is, to say the least, a day that if I were George Floyd's defense attorney, I am calling the prosecutors tonight and saying, what's the offer on the table? Because I can't see how any jury member – what is their entire argument going to be here? That the entire city of Minneapolis is just angry black people? And so that no one in the city can be trusted with their eyes that go along and match pretty much a video that was there? That because they called cops bums and used some salty language? Well, George Floyd then got what he deserved because the bystander was using curse words. Is that what your argument's going to be? It is. If you don't have a guilty verdict on a serious level with this crime, I don't know how you can have any faith in the system at all. The latest update here from Unicorn Riot, and I'll get into a break here. Judge Cahill asked the jury to leave the courtroom. He told Hansen she can't argue with the court and can't argue with the counsel, and that she needed to answer the question she's asked and not to add additional details. She'll be back on the stand tomorrow morning. So it looks like they're wrapping up for the day. And you want to know the truth is this is, you know, so clearly they're attacking the one person, the EMT, the bystander, the EMT bystander. Who is there? That seems what be the defense's strategy here. And that all, you know, well, they didn't cross-examine the kids, but they basically, there were multiple people there. So you were angry, right? Angry black people or just angry bystanders. That doesn't excuse what happened to George Floyd, what Derek Chauvin did to him. It doesn't excuse it. It feels as if we are living in just a lunacy. That this is the equivalent of someone walking up to someone with a gun and shooting them in the face on TV live with hundreds of people witnessing it. And yet people are still arguing, well, that's what you think you saw. No, that's what we saw. And I see a police department that is, if anything, more broken than I've ever seen anything, any government program, government agency in my entire life. The Minneapolis Police Department is the most broken thing. It sounds like now there was another case where Derek Chauvin put a knee to the back of someone's neck. Another case. Clearly he was being told it was okay to do so. These officers clearly seem to have the if they kill the guy, that's the case. I'm angry, I'm sad, I'm disgusted. And if this has not become a massive guilty verdict with a massive sentence, then there is no such thing as justice in this country. Not in this day and age. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. We'll take a break. Come on back. Wrap up the first hour. It's the Matt McNeil Show on AM 950. Going over to Dina Winter's coverage over at Minnesota Reformer here, I'm going to read some of her Twitter feed. So basically, this off-duty firefighter says, something was wrong because firefighters could have responded much sooner than medics. I think she's implying police did not want firefighters to respond. After Chauvin's attorney notes, she called the officer a B-word. Hansen says, I got quite angry after Mr. Floyd was loaded into the ambulance, and there was no point in trying to reason with them anymore because they just killed somebody. When asked about how the crowd was vocal, she said, I don't know. If you've seen anybody be killed, but it's upsetting before the judge cautions her. Earlier, Hansen had testified that Officer Tao had told her, if you're really a firefighter, you should know better. The Chauvin trial picks apart the statement she gave the BCA investigators, and Hansen gets increasingly agitated. Judge is doing a sidebar. Judge advises Hansen not to argue with the court or judge. They have the right to ask questions, Cahill says. She'll return tomorrow morning. Hansen leaves the courtroom, obviously annoyed after Judge Peter Cahill was very stern in telling her not to volunteer information, but just answer the questions. So basically basically she's trying to answer questions as she should as an EMT, and they just want her to answer off of the report that she does. Yeah, no, it's you know, she's clearly pointing out that there was some serious problems in what was going on. And, you know, it's going to be interesting to see how she proceeds. And as a matter of fact, I got to tell you the truth, it's probably this is another bad case, bad outcome from the defense, because her going home is now it's time, one of those things where she's not on the stand now. She gets to come back. Defense is going to go back after her again on the statement. And she'll basically, you know, and their argument is this, is what they want to do is get herself to say something contradictory to what was in the statement. And then they can say, well, you should ignore everything she is because she clearly isn't telling the truth because of this. And so it seems that that's where the defense is going. But I got to tell you the truth. When you look at the 9.5-minute video, you look at what everything that was said today. This is basically, you know, bringing a water pistol to put down the towering inferno at this point. And I just, like I said, I from the testimony I saw today, especially the fact that they multiple times people are saying he's killing him. And at no point did the defense attorney jump up and say, well, you can't say that authoritatively. You're not a medic or you're not a doctor. You'd expect a decent defense attorney to get some of these comments stricken from the record, but he never did. At least it didn't seem like he did. And, yeah, needless to say, this is, like I said, I just, after today, if I'm the defense attorney, I'm calling up and saying, what's the offer on the table? And taking it, because this did not go well for the defense today. But, once again, we're in America, so roll of the dice. It's the Matt McNeil Show, hour two up next. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's the Matt McNeil Show. Matt, Patrick, and Brett Johnson jumping on here. Thank you very much, sir, for filling in tomorrow or yesterday for me.
Yeah, no problem.
I was hiking through the woods. It was nice, especially having open lakes. Now, the lakes down there were clear. They just cleared Minnetonka today. They officially declared ice out, and Sheriff Hutch was out there. I don't know. Is this really a sheriff's job? But he's out in the boat with them, and it's like, okay, we're good.
I take that job. I'll go check the ice.
Put a line in at that point, see if I can get some, you know, panfish at least. I don't know. Well, it's not walleye season. That's later. Can't wait for that. But I did want to give an update on one story that is kind of going on here. A large grass fire in Lionel Lakes is blowing smoke across Interstate 35W, decreasing visibility. It sounds like this fire is still going on. Department of Transportation, it says it's right next to Interstate 35W between Anoka County Road 23, Lake Drive, County Road 14. MnDOT traffic cameras showed a helicopter swooping up nearby water, dumping it on the blaze, and traffic backed up to the interstate. Winds are gusting 40 miles an hour, have aided the fire spread. They had another fire north of that, wasn't it? Wasn't it up in the east central part of the state? Wedena County, was it? There was another one that I heard about. In northwestern Minnesota, stretch of Highway 2 is closed in both directions due to a grass fire there. Strong winds and mobile home caught fire, causing a spread to grassy wooded area in Wedena County. And in western South Dakota, a large fire called the Schroeder Fire burned roughly 1,900 acres. Yikes. Well, there's nothing to stop it out there.
No.
So very high wildfire danger is very high right now. Cool today, tomorrow, and on Thursday, but then back in the 60s, we're going to be 60s and 70s for the next few weeks. I mean, Easter weekend looks fantastic.
Oh yeah, tremendous, and hopefully we don't have these windy conditions that we're getting now, because as you said, causes problems with these fires.
Speaking of fires, Mike Lindell. Actually, I got a twofer for you. Bachman shows up in this one too. Oh, I miss Bubbles.
For some reason, I was thinking Marcus Bachman originally. I don't know why.
He's
no, you're talking Michelle, right?
Michelle, yes. She's the rock. Anyway, we'll start with Lindell. The CEO of MyPillow is still touting wild conspiracy theories about voter fraud in the 2020 election. Most recently, during an appearance on former White House chief strategist Steve Bannon's War Room Pandemic podcast, Lindell baselessly asserted he has evidence that will eventually get to the Supreme Court and overturn the results of the 2020 election. Former Trump president will be back in the office in August, he boldly proclaimed. Trump doesn't have any many allies left who are still publicly claiming the election was rigged, But Lindell was never slowed down, even though he has yet to bring anything remotely noteworthy to the table to back up his baseless claims, which even compelled Newsmax host to walk out in an interview with him earlier this year. Let me ask you, if even he did have evidence, how many Republicans – you've seen how Biden's doing. I mean, he's taking us back to how things used to be. And I think most people in Washington, D.C. are fairly happy, especially with the pandemic, especially with the story that came out this weekend where, you know, they estimated 400,000 deaths were caused by Trump's mishandling of the pandemic crisis. So, you know, even if he had evidence, how many people in Congress are like, no, we're good. We're good. It's, you have, oh, no, we'll keep Joe. We're good here. We don't need him.
After all of these months, yeah, he would finally come up with some sort of piece of evidence, which he clearly doesn't have. But as you said, even if he did, who would listen to him at this point? He's cried wolf so many times. Trump is back in March. Trump is back in August. Now Trump is going to be back by Christmas. Who knows?
Well, one thing that's interesting is I have spent a lot of time going out to parks and stuff in rural Minnesota. I only saw the one Trump flag on the house as I go into Red Wing that was all beat up and looked like it was ready to be condemned. That had a Trump flag on it.
That's representative there.
And a for sale sign in front of it, too.
Even more.
I wonder why the property values aren't going up for this guy. But I went on the trip out to Waterville, which, of course, you go down Faribault, Minnesota 60, head west. I didn't see one Trump flag. Not one. They've taken them down. I think they themselves are like, you know what? Dying from a pandemic needlessly is okay.
He might slowly fade away.
Okay. It's bad.
Yeah. I would feel like if we had primaries today in the Republican Party, every Trump-backed candidate would win. But by 2022, how much does he fade away? Maybe now he has 90% of the sway he once had. Maybe next year it'll only be 40 or 50. I think you're right that sway he has is going down where people just aren't quite as into him as they used to be, for lack of a better way of putting it.
But not everywhere. The MyPillow guy has a friend. On Sunday night, former Representative Michelle Bachmann participated in the World Prayer Network prayer call.
How many times did we say prayer in that thing?
It's the Jesus cast. As a Catholic, I can say this. My guess is they didn't quote a lot from Matthew, but that's just me taking a shrug at it. During what she called the 2020 election a coup driven by voter fraud, inserted that belief that the Congressional Democrats' voting rights bill known as H.R. 1 would forever cement the illegal takeover into place. So she publicly is still saying it's a coup. Back in 11 years ago when I started at this radio station, we placed a microphone between Michelle Bachmann's ears. Let's see if it's still working. Yep, still working. Yeah, there it is. Doesn't seem to be draining a lot of battery power. Anyway, Michelle, I mean, talk about someone who's desperate to stay relevant.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, really outside of, and you know, fringe religious groups. And by the way, I don't know, did you see the story? More than 50% of Americans now do not go to church.
Yeah, I saw that.
That is the least amount, you know, of that. That's the lowest amount in a long time.
Well, what shocked me when I saw that number was 2004. It was up, what, near like 70% of people, and it's dropped that much in just 16, 17 years?
And the people, just these churches don't seem to understand. It's the extremism that's driving people away, but there's Michelle Bachmann, and she's it's the power in the church. These people, it's like the guy that was blessing the guns, you know, blessing the guns up in Pennsylvania.
That was real. You gotta be kidding.
No,
me.
No, that was real. You know, it's these people. It's the power that they use. That they are using religion for their own personal power. They could care less about what Jesus represented or the Christian book, the Bible, anything that would have represented. They're just there for themselves, and it's the saddest thing in the world. But that's who these people are. That's who these people are. You've got Patrick Cooligan. We got to get to this interview here.
That we do, yeah. We're mainly talking about transportation today, including this clean car bill that's being proposed by the Walz administration. We'll focus on that and what that infrastructure bill being proposed by Biden could mean by Minnesota. Patrick breaks down the numbers, and this could be like having about 30 bonding bills coming our way at once. That's how much this transportation bill could do for us. And we'll also touch a little bit on Eric Mortensen, the Republican rep from Shakopee, in a little bit of trouble.
Okay, I got a little bit on that too, plus the Minnesota coronavirus update coming up in a little bit. But right now, Patrick Cooligan, Minnesota reformer, joining us right here on AM 950.
Brett Johnson back with you here on a Tuesday afternoon, and as usual with Tuesday afternoons, we're joined now by Patrick Cooligan, editor-in-chief of the Minnesota Reformer, website minnesotareformer.com to find out the latest in Minnesota politics. Today we'll be talking about a recent column Patrick wrote on clean car emissions, and we'll get into some other political news as well today. Patrick, thanks so much for joining me again.
Always good to be here.
So let's go and talk about this column you just wrote for The Reformer titled Dirty Air and an Overheated Planet, Minnesota Should Enact Clean Car Rules. And this has a lot to do with some clean car rules that are being proposed in Minnesota by the Walz administration, where we would basically be using California kind of as a model. And I'm wondering, Patrick, if you can go and explain a little bit about what this background is on using California as a model, because oftentimes when people hear, oh, wait, we're copying what's happening in California, why are we doing what another state is doing? But as you explain in your column, there actually is quite a history for using California as a basis for environmental regulations.
Right. So the Clean Air Act was passed in 1970, and at the time, California, which has the worst air pollution problem in the country, already had their own clean air law, and it was actually tougher than the federal standard. So what the federal government said, and remember, this is the Richard Nixon administration, they said the states can either adopt our new federal rules or California's rules, which are actually more stringent. Now we're in a different place. There's two different standards. There's kind of the regular auto emission standard. In 2012, the feds and California actually became merged. The feds strengthened their standards and became one with California. We were that way for 8 years. The auto industry survived remarkably, actually thrived during those years. People bought more and more cars and trucks, but the fleet became much more efficient over time. In 2020, last year, the Trump administration said, no, we want to weaken our air pollution standards, and so they separated out from California. What Walz is proposing to do is simply go back to where we were a year ago. That's one part of it. The second part of it is on electric vehicles, and what the Walz administration wants to do is what California and more than a dozen other states have done, representing more than about a third of the population of the U.S., and that is to mandate that that automobile manufacturers sell a certain number of electric vehicles in the state. That is really the more contentious of the two rule changes that are being sought, and it's garnering a lot of resistance.
Yeah, especially from industry groups and dealerships, as their position is, as you wrote about in your column, is that they say they don't care whether they sell gas or electric cars, but they're saying that these rules would actually force them, the dealers, and not the manufacturers, to actually bear the brunt of these changes. Talk about that aspect a little bit and what you make about their claims from at least those industry representatives.
Yeah, they spent in 2020, nearly $700,000, the Minnesota Auto Dealers Association, on what they consider to be, an important political battle. From their standpoint, it's not as if, Ford sends these cars, to the dealers, which the dealer then sells and sends the money back to Ford. That's not how it works. The dealer buys the cars from Ford. And so if the manufacturers force them to buy electric cars, which they then will be, they don't think they'll be able to sell them, and they'll be sitting on their lot, and it will cost them a lot of money. And obviously the worst case scenario would be they go out of business. And they think this is especially a problem in greater Minnesota, where they say, that consumers want gas powered trucks. Those are the big sellers, in greater Minnesota. We have reason to believe that some of their claims are frankly overblown, because it's not as if the government is telling them, you have to sell this electric car. There's a credit system, so they get a they'll have at the beginning of when the regulation would start in model year 2025, they'd have a certain number of credits. If they want to continue to operate as is with no change, they can do that. They just have to buy credits. But there could also, if they're a dealer who sells a lot of electric cars, then they can sell credits. They can trade credits. So there's a the idea is to use a kind of innovative market system to ensure that we have more electric cars in circulation and available to consumers. The benefits of having electric cars are pretty obvious. Air pollution continues to be a problem. Then, of course, there's greenhouse gas emissions, which are making which could make the planet uninhabitable, or not uninhabitable, but could have a devastating effect on the climate. You know, in the coming decades, there's also reason to think that the dealers have their own motive when they are resisting electric cars, and that is that dealers make a lot of their money, nearly half, from parts and service. A lot of people will bring their car in to get serviced or maintained at their dealer, and they make pretty good margins on that on those service and parts. Now the issue is that electric vehicles, they don't require as much maintenance. They have fewer moving parts, and they're cheaper to maintain over the long term, according to Consumer Reports research. So even if unconsciously, they might have another motivation here, and that is cold cash.
And while Republicans have certainly taken advantage of this issue, especially rural Republicans, as they're painting this as being possibly a slippery slope where we could have tractors and even other types of machines that use diesel or gasoline that could all of a sudden be regulated. That's their argument, is saying that really this is about values of rural versus urban. So, yeah, I guess not too surprised that we have Republicans trying to make this into a wedge issue, it appears, for 2022.
Yeah, I think that every time that you can make an issue a cultural issue and polarize it, it's a fast way to mobilize your base, and I think that's what they're trying to do. They've really been appealing to Greater Minnesota folks, and I think they're turning this into a metro versus Greater Minnesota thing. You know, you throw around the word California, I think that automatically, for whatever reason, that really just amps up the Republican base. You had a Republican senator actually come out and say that the new rules would apply to tractors and diesel generators, and of course it's not true. He kind of walked it back, but, you know, who knows whether or not he was being sincere when he says he's sorry that he kind of gave some wrong information, but yeah, they've really and they spent a lot of money on it too, and now they have a bill on the floor of the Senate, probably going to come to the floor of the Senate, the Republican-controlled state Senate, where they would roll back the administration's ability to regulate auto emissions. It's not going to go anywhere because the governor would veto it, and it's not going to pass the Democratic-controlled House. But it's an indication of how fired up they are about this issue.
And the final point on your piece, and this is something you made towards the end of your column, and that's generally that, well, regulation doesn't always stifle innovation, even though that's the typical talking point we get. And you point out an example back in the 1970s when we were having the debate over lead gasoline. Well, us putting regulations and saying we can't have leaded gas anymore, well, that actually forced a lot of our manufacturing car companies to innovate and better compete with cars that were being made out of Germany and Japan. So in essence, regulation is not always a bad thing when it comes to innovation.
Right. And in fact, the Germans and Japanese are a good example. Both of those countries have very heavy-handed regulatory regimes. I think even today, people would say that they make superior cars to the domestically produced cars. But certainly this was an issue in the 70s when we had the introduction of these clean air rules, and the American auto industry had no choice but to start innovating and creating more efficient cars. And as it happened, this aligned well with consumer taste and help them compete against the Germans and the Japanese, who at the time were starting to really eat up market share rapidly because they're producing superior cars. And you see this in other examples where government says, especially in environmental law, where the government is forcing companies to innovate, and they often respond.
We're speaking with Patrick Houlihan. He is the editor-in-chief of the Minnesota Reformer. I want to stay on the transportation theme because right now at the federal level, we have U.S. Democrats proposing a $3 trillion infrastructure deal. And in your newsletter for the Minnesota Reformer today, you did some math on what exactly a $3 trillion infrastructure deal could mean for a state like Minnesota. And breaking down the math, you talked about how if Minnesota just received about 1% of that $3 trillion, that would be $30 billion that would be coming into our state for infrastructure needs, which would be, what, like 20 or 30 possible bonding bills. And you even point out that typically we get more than 1% of funding from these types of federal bills. And this could have a massive impact on Minnesota's economy and especially our infrastructure. If you just do the math and think about having 20 or 30 bonding bills basically being crammed all into one year, there could be a lot of projects that could be completed in Minnesota transportation-wise.
Right. I don't know that it would be, you know, 1 year, but even over 5 years, it's just a mind-blowing amount of money. I've been at the legislature when Republicans were telling Democrats, you know, if you like $1.5 billion bonding bill, like, why won't you accept this Enbridge pipeline that's $2.5 billion? But now we're talking about $30 billion, like you said, if it's 1% of the $3 trillion, and $60 billion. I mean, the Viking Stadium cost the state, you know, $500 million. You could build 120 Viking stadiums. You know, light rail line, it costs us, maybe a little more than $1 billion, so that you could do, you know, how many light rail lines? Of course, and it's not just transportation. It's all kinds of infrastructures, all kinds of needed water infrastructure, especially in greater Minnesota. So yeah, it was just—it's just astounding to think about what Joe Biden is hoping to accomplish here, and the impact it could have in every corner of our state.
Now I want to move on to some other political news today, and this is something you guys broke just a little earlier today, and that has to do with a Shakopee Republican Representative Eric Mortensen. This is a name you might remember. He was just elected back in the 2020 election cycle. He's the guy that invited Governor Tim Walz to his backyard for a barbecue to defy some of the COVID restrictions that have been put in place. He was also elected back in 2020, thanks in large part to having a legalized cannabis candidate that ended up probably taking away a lot of votes from the Democratic candidate. And Mortensen is also infamous for giving out the cell phone number of Democratic Representative Jamie Becker Finn and, well, basically doxing her cell phone number. So this guy certainly has quite the track record, even though he was just recently elected. And, well, now Mortensen is in a little bit of possible trouble, as the DFL has filed a complaint with the Campaign Finance Board against Mortensen, saying he illegally coordinated with a nonprofit group to attack political opponents. The name of this group, by the way, is the North Star Liberty Alliance. And what I find interesting about this here, Patrick, is that this group was attacking both Republicans and Democrats. Republicans for not being conservative enough, and, well, Democrats for obvious reasons. And the DFL is alleging that Mortensen was coordinating with this group, which would be a violation. So it's interesting to look at this lawsuit and see who North Star Liberty Alliance has been going after. And now we have these allegations from the DFL against Mortensen coordinating with them.
Right. So Mortensen is part of something called the New House Republican Caucus, or sort of a breakaway caucus from the House Republicans. They don't think that the Republicans in the House are conservative enough. They like to do these kind of publicity stunts. Sometimes they're successful. One of their members last week proposed seceding from Minnesota, that a big swath of western Minnesota would secede from Minnesota and join South Dakota. It's kind of ha-ha. I mean, it's obviously not legal. Not going to happen, but they get some headlines out of it and kind of grow their mailing list and maybe get some donations. There's currently five of them. Mortensen is one of them. And so that's where you see them, where it's they're attacking their fellow Republicans. They're trying to wrestle control of the Republican caucus in the state house. Mortensen is kind of a master at this kind of politics, even though he's only been there, like you said, he's only been in the legislature a few months, but this is his whole style. The problem is now he's apparently he's got this nonprofit group. There's two problems with it. One is that it seems like it's a pretty openly political group, but it's not registered with the State Campaign Finance Board, which regulates political spending campaign activities of both candidates and outside groups. And the other is that they're alleging that he's coordinating with the group, which you're not supposed to do as a candidate. So we'll see how this plays out. Our reporter at the Capitol, Ricardo Lopez, and I were kind of marveling at this guy's ability to keep showing up in the Minnesota Reformer. We're not sure what to do because he keeps making news. On the other hand, you know, how much do you want to boost this guy's signal and kind of amplify him? So that's kind of our little bit of our conflict there. But as soon as as long as he keeps making news, I think we'll keep covering him. But I think he might be in for a rude awakening in 2022. His opponent in 20, Brad Tabke, has already declared he's running. And he won in a very close election, and so we'll just have to see. But I'm not really sure that a suburban swing district really wants this kind of Trumpian insult comic lawmaker to be representing them.
And the other piece I got a kick out of reading through this is that Mortensen is alleging that Republicans and the DFL were working together on this complaint, saying that, well, we, of course, have Republicans that are angry about being attacked and DFLers being angry about being attacked, and somehow they're working together to bring through this lawsuit. And I believe he was asked for any proof of the DFL coordinating with the GOP, and, well, lo and behold, he didn't have any, which, well, to me is not that big a surprise considering his background.
Yeah, he's not getting back to the Reformer very quickly when we ask him for comments.
I don't anticipate him having you on speed dial there to get back.
he's blaming Minority Leader Kurt Dowd. And I mean, I will say that you can see in some of the bills that have been proposed that the Breakaway Caucus has proposed a bill that is aimed at Kurt Dowd's his job, as he's a head of a public affairs of a D.C.-based lobbying firm. They've taken aim at that. I can tell you that in no uncertain terms, that the Republican leadership and this breakaway caucus, they really despise each other. It's pretty amusing, but they're playing for keeps.
Yeah, most certainly sounds like it. Well, Patrick, we are unfortunately up against the clock, so we'll have to leave it there for this week. Again, that was Patrick Houlihan, editor-in-chief of the Minnesota Reformer. Great resource to follow along the latest in Minnesota politics over at MinnesotaReformer.com. Patrick, as always, appreciate the time today.
Good to be here.
All right, let's take a break, and we're going to turn things back over to Matt McNeil up next on AM 950.
AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota, is the Matt McNeil Show. Hey, Patrick, I've got two disturbing breaking news items. Which one do you want to hear first? Ick or ee? I'll give it your choice on that.
I'm a guy who, I think we should go with the ee.
All right. the Department of Justice is now investigating Congressman Matt Gaetz for allegedly having a relationship with a 17-year-old girl and trafficking. Wow. Yeah. Ugh.
That is definitely
Matt Gaetz. Now, if you missed the earlier story, and this must have been, he must have known something was coming down the line. because earlier today there was a story that broke that said he was going to resign his seat, not run again, and go to Newsmax. But even I've got to believe Newsmax is not going to want him on the air there. That's one story. Here's another one. A gun shop in Osseo is facing heavy criticism on social media after allegedly sent an email advertising ammunition for customers for a trip to the hood. Wow. Several customers left unfavorable reviews on the Osseo Gun Club and Pro Shop's Facebook page after getting the email sometime late last week. The store's Facebook page has since been deactivated, but many have shared the image of the advertisement listing 9 styles of firearms that just arrived. The email also lists Smith & Wesson 9mm, STV 40 handguns, as well as March specials. Near the bottom of the email and in parentheses, the ad reminds shoppers that we have 30-round mags for your next trip to the hood because, hey, they're implying you want to go kill black people. Ha ha, what? 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 Seriously, you just had 2 mass shootings in this country, you jackasses. We have 30-round mags for your trip to the hood because, hey, you want 30 rounds to kill 30 minorities, right? That's what the Osseo Gun Club and Pro Shop is putting out there. Oh, my God. Some took to social media to ask if the shop is promoting. You don't have to ask if the shop is promoting and advocating violence in the inner city. The shop is advocating and promoting violence in the inner city when they put out there, we have 30-round mags for your next trip to the hood. Wow. Wow. At least one person on Facebook called for a boycott of the store. In a review of the gun shop, St. Paul resident Alfonso Fleming Jr. called the email deplorable and beyond racist. There is zero human in suggesting a person carrying additional bullets into neighborhoods or any geographical area with the intent to use them, he wrote. Attempts to reach the store management. Cowards, cowards, cowards. You're all cowards. You're all cowards. I'm calling you a bunch of cowards. And you got your guns on your hip and you're sitting there playing tough guy. But I'm calling you a bunch of freaking cowards because now you're hiding because you people saw that email and are upset. You're a bunch of cowards. Weak, small, tiny cowards. If I'm wrong, get out in the media and defend yourselves. God, tired of these people. The Osseo Gun Club, which opened in 2014, describes itself from the website as a local woman-owned business, providing a family-friendly facility for people of all ages to enjoy shooting sports. Well, not, of course, the people who live in the quote-unquote hood. Those people are targets, apparently. Oh, dear Lord. And we just had three, Virginia Beach, Boulder, Colorado, Atlanta. 3 mass shootings in this country. Once again, I want to read this verbatim. This is out of the Star Tribune. We have 30-round mags for your trip to the hood. You guys should be shut down. You should be shut down. You're so damn reckless. You're actually encouraging violence, gun violence in the city. Dear Lord. Well, on that bright note, we'll take a break. Come on back. Get the coronavirus update in. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. It is the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's the Matt McNeil Show. 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205. We might have time for a call here if you want to chat about the Derek Chauvin trial, anything else. We got the Minnesota coronavirus update right now. Positivity rate for COVID-19 testing rose back above the Minnesota 5% caution threshold on Tuesday, reflecting a month-long increase in infections despite the state's vaccination progress. A key benchmark in viral spread in Minnesota, the 5.2% positivity rate is less than the peak of 15.5% on November 10th, but an increase from a low of 3.5% on March 3rd. The state on Tuesday also reported one COVID-19 death, 1,278 diagnosed infections, the novel coronavirus that causes the disease, bringing the overall pandemic totals to 6,836 deaths, 517,881 infections. State health officials have warned renewed pandemic activity in Minnesota because of more infectious variants of the SARS virus. This is COVID virus, spring break travels, and some weakening of mask wearing and social distancing compliance. The rate of Minnesotans who always wear masks in public has slipped from 79% in mid-February to 74%, according to a state survey published by the Institute of Health Metrics and Evaluation at Washington State. The rate remains among the highest in the Midwest, with only 52% of people in South Dakota always wearing a mask in public. Yikes. Yikes. The key question remains whether the increasing diagnosed infections will result in the same trends that occurred in the spring and fall with subsequent increases in hospitalizations and deaths. The number of COVID-19 patients admitted to Minnesota hospital beds has increased from 210 on March 6 to 357 on Monday. Although that growth has leveled off in recent days and doctors are reporting younger patients with more favorable outcomes when compared to prior pandemic waves. Still, that is 147 more cases in less than a month. A measurable increase in deaths has not yet occurred. The state health officials are hopeful that vaccination progress is preventing Minnesotans from suffering severe COVID-19 illnesses. And that's actually one thing that is true. That is that because the governor and the state did such a good job rolling out the vaccinations for particularly the most susceptible groups, that basically that I think that that's going to keep these death numbers down. That's at least what a lot of the experts are saying, is you're going to see an increase in cases, maybe an increase in hospitalizations, but deaths might not come in where they did in the third wave. Still, though, we are definitely in a fourth wave. A measurable increase in deaths has not yet occurred. The state on Tuesday reported that 1,637,771 people have received at least one dose of COVID-19 vaccine. 3,316 have completed the series by receiving two doses of the Moderna or Pfizer vaccines or a single dose of the Johnson & Johnson version. Roughly 37% of eligible Minnesotans are 16 and older have at least received a first dose. So I think we're getting close to almost 20% of the state vaccinated, which is pretty good. 37% of the state, eligible state, people in the state getting at least one dose of vaccine, and near 20% vaccinated. That's pretty good. More than 81% of senior citizens in Minnesota have received COVID-19 vaccine, having been prioritized among the healthcare workers. Minnesota expanded vaccine eligibility on Tuesday to all 4.4 million people, 16 and older, but many providers are continuing to give doses first to these groups at elevated risk for viral infection. Walls and state officials recently relaxed mitigating restrictions designed to reduce viral spread, in part because of confidence of vaccination. Capacity levels were expanded last month for bars and restaurants, and numerical participation caps were eliminated for worship services in Minnesota. On Thursday, indoor-outdoor event venues will be allowed to resume activities. I got to tell you the truth, though. I'm not going back to church. I'm not going to the gym. I'm not. Not until we get enough people. I went past a movie theater and you could smell the popcorn. And boy, did it smell freaking delicious. Movie theater popcorn, sensational. I'm not going to go to a movie. I'm not. Just, you gotta take this seriously till the end. Which then gets us to the next story. God. The Hill Murray boys hockey team, beset with a COVID-19 exposure from a recent game, is suing to keep it from having to forfeit its appearance at the boys hockey state tournament. Repeat after me. But, it's the playoffs! God. How are my parodies coming true? How in the hell are my parodies coming true? Stop it. I'm not supposed to sound competent. A lawsuit filed on Tuesday on behalf of nine players seeks to prevent the Minnesota State High School League from enforcing COVID-19 guidelines to prevent the team from playing until Thursday. The team has sought guidance about whether they could play after learning of an alleged positive COVID-19 test involving an opponent from its March 24th sectional final game. The suit filed in Washington County District Court claims Minnesota Department of Health guidelines would allow the Pioneers to play on Thursday. Hill Murray is scheduled to play Wayzata Class 2A quarterfinal 11 a.m. on Wednesday at XL Energy Center. The lawsuit says Wayzata has graciously agreed to reschedule the game to Thursday. See, we haven't, even though we haven't gone to you guys, we've taken care of the whole thing here. We've done it all ourselves, for goodness sakes. Now let us play. God, Reach for comment Tuesday. High school league spokesman said the league does not comment on pending, threatening, or existing litigation. Hill Murray canceled practice Monday. You were practicing? I thought you guys were supposed to be in quarantine, you idiots. Am I missing something? You were exposed to a guy with COVID, and you're having a practice. What? What? Wait a second. You were exposed. You were exposed to a White Bear Lake player. And that was right. It was White Bear Lake, right? Yeah, it was a White Bear Lake player. And yet you're supposed to be in quarantine. And you're having practices? But it's the playoffs! Jesus. Hill Murray canceled practice Monday while it sought guidance from the league on the matter. According to the suit, the team learned of the possible positive COVID test after its 5-0 victory over White Bear Lake in advance of the state tournament. The suit says Hill Murray players had almost no contact with the infected player from White Bear Lake and that when contact occurred, all players were wearing masks. The format of this year's tournament provides a day between the quarterfinals and the semifinals that is usually not available. High School League is holding the semifinals and finals in the girls' state tournament this week as it seeks to compete the winter sports delayed 6 weeks by the surge of virus transmission. According to the suit, there is no impediment to allowing the rescheduling of the game to occur on Thursday in the girls' tournament, which holds its semifinal class A, 2A, and 1A at XL. Wayzata High School issued a statement Tuesday saying we've left every option for Hill Murray to find a solution and feel badly about the situation. COVID exposure also has led Hermantown to the number one seed in the Class 1A boys hockey tournament to suit up 15 junior varsity players for its 6 p.m. Tuesday game against the unseeded Dodge County. All but three of the Hawks varsity members are in quarantine because apparently Hermantown is doing it right. Here are two things I'm going to. This is just wild speculation on this. I almost would Hill Murray if the shoe was on the other foot, and Wayzata had the sick kids, or the kids that have been exposed. Would Hill Murray be willing to give them the mulligan? Or would Hill Murray saying, sucks to be you, forfeit, we move into the semis? I don't know. I can't say for sure. But it's a legit question. And here's the other thing, too. Okay, say this does happen, and then you play a game on Thursday, then but you have to turn around and play a game on Friday, and then you get beat on Friday. Are you going to sue the Minnesota High School League? Because it wasn't fair. We had to play a day beforehand. We didn't get the day off. It hurts. Is that what's going to happen? Is that what's going to happen, Boo Boo Kitty? Is that what's going to happen? Dear Lord. Here is my problem. Here is my problem. You all, we saw you in August, in October, in December. Let the kids play and we'll be careful. We'll follow the rules. That's what you guys said. You guys said, you know, we'll follow protocols. We'll, if we have to go into quarantine, we'll do it so you can get to play. And now here we are playing. And this is exactly the scenario we were concerned about. But playoffs. And that becomes That becomes the most important thing. I mean, it, at least it sounds incredibly selfish. It does. This is why there are parents and players and coaches and the schools have no intention of doing what's best for the community or what's best for the kids so they don't get sick and they don't end up in a hospital. The only thing that matters is there's a trophy to be won. That's the only thing that matters. That's at least from the fact that you're filing a lawsuit. Tell me what other message you're sending here. Tell me what other message you're sending. You're being cautious? No, that's not it. You respect you're honoring the fact that you guys stood by and said, you know what, let them play. We'll be careful. And it's unfortunate. And you guys want to get mad at White Bear Lake? By all means, get mad at White Bear Lake. But then are you going to pay for any hospital bills for the kids from Wayzata if they get sick? Are you? Kids sports, high school, just, yeah, you know, it's a shame we all saw this train coming down the tracks, isn't it? 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205. We'll wrap up the show when we come back. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It is the Matt McNeil Show. They're suing
to play a tournament game.
Come on, Matt. You don't get it, Matt. There's a trophy.
No, I get it. I have seen way too much of it, as a matter of fact, for the last year. That's exactly what I've seen.
Going back to what Cooligan was talking about with Brett here, the Minnesota Reformer story, on Representative Skin Tag, Eric Mortensen. By the way, first of all, I'll tell you this. My guess is Eric Mortensen will not win re-election. It will be a monstrous landslide against him because most of the people in Shakopee I know have said everyone is angry at that this guy played himself off as this kind of moderate Republican, middle of the road guy, and he is, you know, he's Rod Graham's did. He's far right extreme on it. But there's one part of the Reformer story I thought was pretty funny. Mortensen, a first time lawmaker, issued a video response to the complaint calling it completely false and meritless. He also accuses Republicans of coordinating with Democrats to file the complaint. Wait a minute. No. Wait a second here. If it's false and meritless, then why would you be complaining about what the Republicans coordinated with the Democrats for when they filed the complaint? It would seem to me that that's implying that the Republicans worked and gave them information, which then would mean that it's not false and meritless. Well, needless to say, it will all get worked out in the courts. Good luck. We're back tomorrow. Till then, see ya.